My name is Rain Hirsch. I am a conductor and a comedian, and welcome to Prongs in the Pub, my unofficial and slightly irreverent podcast about the BBC Proms, one of, if not the greatest music festival on the planet. So the Proms has started. Now, mixing up my attendance this year, I decided to watch the first night live on BBC Two, and very agreeable it was too. Verdi's 90-minute Requiem. Great to see the crowds back, and of course, sound and visuals of a different order. That said, I couldn't help feeling the teleshow was, well, a bit of smash and grab. We joined the Albert Hall just 15 minutes before showtime and left pretty smartly with the applause. Our host was news reporter Clive Myrie, last seen talking about the Russian invasion from a balcony in Kyiv. This time, though, he was looking very trendy. Scarf, beads, plimsolls. Never seen him looking quite so arty before. Was it that, or was it the BBC wardrobe department in overdrive? A short report from Tom Service, who was born in Glasgow and who speaks like this and is perpetually excited about being anywhere or doing anything. Then the BBC Symphony Orchestra plus the biggest bass drum you've ever seen, though with one or two dents in it where somebody's probably whacked it a bit too hard. And a bizarre instrument at the end of the brass section which looked like an early device for collecting microwave transmissions called a chimbasso. I had to look that up, by the way. Replacing the Ophiclide, I had to look that up as well, a now defunct brass instrument that Verdi originally put in the score. Three excellent soloists. I wasn't so massively impressed by Kawan Sim, the bass baritone, but he was the only one who wasn't huge, and maybe that affects his sound. Yeah, if you're a person who likes big women, the sopranos Masabani Cecilia Raguanasha and mezzo-soprano Jennifer Johnston wouldn't have disappointed. Granted, the camera angles didn't do them any favours. At one point, we were literally looking up Masabani's nose. Oh, there was also the moment in which they simultaneously sang this. Didn't think it was that bad. Actually, it turns out that was fack, not the word we were all thinking of. As you probably know, fack is what Irish people say when they want to say the word that we were all thinking of, but don't dare. But it was a moving performance, although for my money, Verdi's Requiem is a piece in which I tend to drift in and out a little bit, with only occasional whack on a bass drum, and this. To wake me up. If you live in the UK, you too can catch the telly show on demand for the next 11 months. Or if you don't live in the UK, check out BBC Sounds, where you can hear the first night and all the Proms in this season until the 10th of October. I must stress that we're nothing to do with the BBC, but I hope you're enjoying this podcast nevertheless for its own special unofficial take. Please don't forget to subscribe, leave a comment, and you can get in touch with us at www.promsinthepub.co.uk. Now to our guest, who is Chief Music Critic of the Daily Telegraph, also a broadcaster, university lecturer, and sometime Thunderbirds enthusiast. He wrote the music for a live stage show of Thunderbirds a few years back. He is Ivan Hewitt, who in a weak moment agreed to appear on Proms in the Pub, and to show him that this podcast is not just messing about, there was a quiz. Well, I thought, Ivan, if you excuse me this, that people want to know what it is that makes critics tick, right? What are their references? Where are they coming from? So I thought we'd start this, if you don't mind, with an either-or series of questions. Either-or, and you've just got to say, you get two choices, and you've just got to jump to the one that most appeals. You ready for this?
Okay, all set.
Wine or beer?
Beer.
Okay, love or money?
Definitely love.
Good. Book or film?
Book.
Thunderbirds or Captain Scarlet?
Oh, that's really hard. Thunderbirds.
Yeah, I know your history with Thunderbirds, by the way, aren't I? Scarface or The Godfather?
Godfather?
Yeah, okay. Facebook or Twitter?
Twitter.
Being able to speak German or being able to speak Italian?
I'm struggling with both. So, Italian.
Yeah, okay. Your wife is Italian, so that's probably, you know, she yeah, listens to this.
Right answer.
Spotify or vinyl disc?
Spotify, but I'm a bit embarrassed to say that. Because, you know, you know, Spotify's a bit of a monster, like it's all streaming services. But I don't have a vinyl player, so what can I do?
Yeah, exactly. It's all a nice idea in practice until you put it on and hear all that scratching. Radio 3 or Classic FM?
Radio 3.
Opera or musical?
Opera.
Happy ending or sad ending?
Ooh, sad.
Yeah, okay. Now, slightly more musical, if you're thinking of this. Liszt or Chopin?
You're supposed to say Chopin, aren't you? It's a bit kind of, because Liszt is thought to be vulgar. So I'm going to say Liszt.
Good for you. Wagner or Verdi?
Verdi.
Mahler or Bruckner?
Bruckner,
okay,
sure.
Yeah, that's, there we go. Rachmaninoff or Prokofiev?
Ooh.
Hard.
God. I guess, yeah, Prokofiev, I guess.
Peter Maxwell Davis or Harrison Birtwistle?
Definitely Birtwistle.
Good. Chicago Symphony or Vienna Philharmonic?
Ooh. Maybe Chicago, because they always play like they really mean it, and Vienna can be a bit complacent.
All right, Chicago Symphony or Berlin Philharmonic?
I think in that case, Berlin.
Yeah, good. Tonal or atonal?
Oh, I'd be a total fraud. Anyone who says atonal is a fraud, I think. It's got to be tonal.
Okay, good. And being asked either-or questions or being smashed in the face with a custard tart. I'm just reaching into my bag now. No, that is not a real question. Well, there it is. Now we know all about you.
Right, so what have I scored?
You haven't scored anything. There's no right.
Oh,
one.
Right. It's just going to be...
Yeah,
those...
No, there's probably a psychologist out there who's ticking boxes. Doing those splodge diagrams that goes, oh, he's that. So this is about the proms. And obviously, first thing, for those people who have just landed on a spaceship, maybe it's people listening abroad, actually, what are the proms? How would you define them?
The proms is an 8-week immersion and also education in mostly classical music.
Mm.
Some people complain that, you know, the proportion of classical music is dwindling these days.
Mm.
I mean, a little bit, but it's still overwhelmingly classical music, played by a big range of orchestras, chamber players. It's centred on the Royal Albert Hall, which some people hate as a venue, other people absolutely love, but increasingly it goes out to other venues.
Yeah.
For chamber music, and now, this year, around the country, you know, we're going to get proms from the Sage Gateshead, for example.
Truro,
that's the nicest one, isn't it? It's very Catholic in its taste, you know. Because of that, of course, it always displeases some people, you know. There'll always be people who'll say, why isn't there more Havergal Brian? That seems to be a perennial complaint, you know. Mm. Why is there so much contemporary music? Why isn't there more contemporary music? But if you are coming new to classical music, and you don't want to resort to a streaming service, and you don't really like listening to CDs, you want it live, in other words, you could hardly do better than just go every night to the proms for a season.
Mm.
You'll come away having heard a pretty good cross-section of the tradition.
One thing we must add in there, it's principally orchestral as well, and which, you know...
Yes, very important point, which I've somehow failed to make. It is principally orchestral because it suits the venue.
Yeah.
It's a big place, holds nearly 6,000 people. It's especially well suited to, I mean, not just orchestral music, but big orchestral music, you know, with chorus, you know. So this year's season starts with Verdi's Requiem, and then that suits the hall really well. It also suits Mahler's symphonies very well, because you can put the offstage brass in a place where it actually sounds really good, and not like they've just been tucked outside the artist entrance, you know, and it sounds a bit naff, as it can do in other halls. In the Albert Hall, it sounds really good.
It suits the venue, but actually the gig chose the venue rather than the other way around, if you see what I mean, because it used to be in the Queen's Hall, which was opposite, or very close to, what is now the BBC. In fact, it was this. It's a kind of, if you see old pictures of that, it looks like a kind of Albert Hall just dumped north of Oxford Circus. I mean, that's what it was, until the Nazis thought as good to firebomb the place in 1940-something.
1941, I think.
Yeah.
It was destroyed. There's a tiny fragment of wall left there.
Yeah, I've heard about that. In some sort of, you know, corridor somewhere, you can see that. Have you seen it?
Yeah, it's on some little cul-de-sac off Great Portland Street, I think. But yes, you're right, it was a big place, and of course, back in those days, in the late 1890s, they weren't so concerned about health and safety rules, and so thousands and thousands were packed into a space. People were allowed to smoke, you know.
There's a brilliant thing about, you know, they only ask that gentlemen don't light matches during the music or something.
That's right. That's right. And they were also earnestly requested not to blow smoke in the faces of the ladies, as this was impolite. But you could promenade around, you know, as the name suggests.
Yeah.
There was a big fountain in the middle, and people would cheer when their favourite, euphonium soloist would come on, because in those days, the music was much more geared to individuals than institutions, you know. So you didn't get just this polite applause for the Queen's Hall Orchestra as a whole. People would let rip when the euphonium player arrived, you know, or the cornet player.
Mm.
And in the early days, programmes were quite a miscellany, you know, as concerts generally were in those days.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a sober thing of this symphony followed by this concerto. You might have those things, but interspersed in them would be cornet solo from Mr. Humphreys,
yeah.
You know, soprano aria from Miss Davis.
Yes, variations on, you know,
that's
Rossini's
right.
Something or other.
That's right.
And it went on too. I mean, the original concerts were like 3 hours, like every night.
Yes, you certainly got value for money in those days. It was closer to a sort of music hall or a sort of variety show than a serious concert of today.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about it is, you know, this you talk about Catholic programming, but in the early days, I mean, apart from these kind of bizarre, trivial kind of virtuoso numbers, they played all the Beethoven symphonies every year. They played all the Brahms symphonies. I mean, it was just a standard. There was a Monday night with Wagner night. I mean, it was bizarre. I mean, this kind of regularity, and it was probably pretty easy to program, really, because, you know, you just ticked off. And they played all the Beethoven symphonies, except the last movement of the ninth, which they just kind of left out. It just seems odd, doesn't it?
It seems very odd. But, I mean, a number of things were odd about programming in those days.
Mm.
But, you know, the aims were very high-minded. You know, Henry Wood said, by degrees, I'm going to raise the public taste.
You know,
he actually said that. Imagine saying that now.
No.
And he did it. He pulled it off, you know. But he was quite a stubborn man, I think. And if people didn't like a new piece first time around, he'd just give it to them again and again until they did, you know. So he managed to bring them around to Debussy, who became quite a popular favourite.
But one thing the Proms isn't, for anybody listening in the US of A, it is not the party you get at the end of your, you know, high school, which we only vaguely understand. I'm not sure I got those words right. High school, anyway, it's not that.
It's not the high school prom.
But oddly, in the US of A, and also in Canada, for example, which we used to own, as we did the US of A, in fact, in times gone by, they know the phrase, last night of the Proms, but they have no idea what it means.
Yes, it's a very strange thing about the Proms, and it's I can't think of another music festival anywhere in the world where the last night is so very different to the rest of the festival.
Yeah.
It's a very odd thing. It seems to float free somehow.
And
many people know the festival only from the last night.
Yeah.
Which is a bit unfortunate, because only the first half of the last night is in any way like the rest of the Proms.
Yeah, what do you think of the last night, since we're on it?
Ooh, well, this is that killer question, you know, that's bound to bring down a heap of anger on your head, whether you're for or against it. Well, the kind of jingoistic bit at the end, I wince at the thought of it, but the truth of it is that when I'm actually there in the hall, I stand up and I sing along lustily to Jerusalem.
You've been?
I go every year.
Do you?
In my official capacity.
Oh, really?
Absolutely. People say that, you know, it's time to reinvent the last night because it's, you know, it's an embarrassment. And some people who are even more severe say it's worse than an embarrassment. It's actually, it reveals a kind of innate hankering for a restoration of empire.
Yeah.
An accusation which I think is truly fantastical. You know, in my 2 years of interviewing audiences at the Proms, which I did for my contribution towards a recent history of the Proms, I can truly say I never found anyone who was hankering for the empire. Everyone who sings along to that song, except perhaps the foreigners, of which there are many, knows that it's absurd, you know. And it's a kind of exercise in self-mockery, I think, which everyone enjoys, and it's especially the foreigners, who I think perhaps enjoy that sing-along more than anybody else, you know. And then there is something, I have to admit, bizarre about seeing a group of Chinese students waving a flag of the People's Republic of China and singing Rule Britannia. That is very bizarre, but one can enjoy it for its oddity, you know, and its absurdity.
You spent 2 years talking to Promise, which sounds like a I don't know, something you might have done for a Duke of Edinburgh award. But they are a fascinating group. I've been a prommer, and I'm looking forward to being one again. But tell me about your observations as somebody actually going in there and finding out.
Well, I was hanging around outside the building, talking to people in all the queues, not just the promming queues, but all of them, you know, because I didn't want to make it overly weighted towards the prommers who stand in the middle. But as it turned out, they said very similar things, actually. It was common to encounter families, you know, mums and dads who knew the proms and had come up from Bournemouth or down from Leicester to give their kids a taste of this thing that they already knew they loved. And in many cases, maybe practically all the cases, the kids had some acquaintance with it because of the TV. So they had some vague notion of what they were in for, you know, and they seemed genuinely interested, and they were enjoying the fact that it was a day out, you know, it was a good way to go to London and have a really good time. It was the trust that they placed in the proms' taste that was interesting, because very often they would say, I don't really know much about classical music, and I've heard there's something modern tonight, which I don't really understand, but it's the proms, you know, so it's going to be fine. That was often the kind of burden of it, that they trusted the institution of the proms to have decent taste, but not entirely conservative taste, and if it was something new, there'd be a good reason for that, and if they didn't even maybe understand it too well, there'd be a good reason for that too.
So yeah. Henry Wood would be delighted by that, wouldn't he?
He would.
Because that's exactly what he was trying to achieve.
He would, and it shows a real continuity, because as well as talking to the people outside, the real life proms goers outside the building in the period leading up to the start of the proms, leading up to the concert itself, I did a bit of delving into the archive to find out, because the BBC is very assiduous about doing audience research.
Mm.
And you'd find these very touching things, like people would say, I've just heard Copland's Appalachian Spring, or something, given its prom premiere in 46 or something like that. I didn't really understand the music, but I'm sure I will like it very much on future hearings. There was this touching belief that they really ought to stick with it, because if they did, then the faith they put in the proms' taste would be vindicated, So it's that trust I found really kind of touching. And there's an enormous kind of emotional investment. There was one woman who said that when she died, she said, I want my ashes to be scattered here. She said, don't tell anyone. She said, just bring my ashes up and scatter them in the bushes.
If you find that the fountain isn't working, no time, what's this? All clogged up in here. Oh, come over here, Charlie. Somebody's spread a lot of ashes down here. I thought it wasn't smoking no more, especially not striking matches during the performance.
In fact, one interviewee actually, having talked about how he adored the proms, gave me a slightly suspicious look and said, you think I'm mad, don't you? But the best remark I had was from an American visitor. On the last night, there was a party who were dressed up in tuxedo, and the ladies were in fine gowns, And I was talking to these guys, and one of them came up to me and he pumped my hand and said, because this is going back a bit, this is the time of the Iraqi war. And he said, I just want you to remember, we stand with you shoulder to shoulder. And coming to the proms was an illustration of this, the fact that they stood shoulder to shoulder, because this was a great patriotic event. And the woman standing next to him said, oh yeah, the proms are so great, they go back to 1400, right? I couldn't bear to put her right on that, so I just let it go.
Well, here's the thing, so the proms has become much more international. We talked about, actually, we didn't talk about in the early stages, it was, one conductor, one orchestra, all the solos were British. Well, it was a less international age. And now it is really an international event. You get orchestras coming from all over the world and soloists and all the rest of it. But is the proms famous internationally?
Yes, I would say so. I mean, it's that, and that's been true for a long time. In fact, my first exposure to the proms, I think, although this might be an invented memory, but I think it was via the BBC World Service. Because many of my summers were spent outside the country, in foreign parts where my parents were living.
Hmm.
And I think I first heard the proms in Beirut, in the same year that the Soviets invaded Czechoslovakia. It felt very soothing and comforting to have this very plummy BBC voice, in the kind of disorder of Beirut, which was a very, you know, a turbulent place in that year of you know, shortly after the Six-Day War, lots of anti-Brit and anti-American demonstrations.
Yeah.
So to hear something soothing, like the BBC Symphony Orchestra play Flos Campi or something, was very nice.
Yeah,
I don't think there's any festival anywhere. You think of the Proms as rivals, okay? Like Lucerne, the Salzburg Festival, the Summer Festival in Bucharest, actually, which you might not think of, but actually has an extraordinary array of international orchestras, are also very impressive, but I don't think they rival the Proms.
No.
You know, in terms of visitors.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's wonderful. And it's, some people say, what a great shame it is to hear such a great orchestra as the Berlin Philharmonic in such a lousy acoustic as the Albert Hall.
Yeah.
But honestly, I don't mind the acoustic. It, admittedly, it's very eccentric and patchy.
Mm.
You know, you can be in one area where it's pretty decent
and
then move 10 seats to your right and it's terrible.
Yeah.
You know, Thomas Beecham used to say it was a great experience for a young composer to have a piece premiered in the Royal Albert Hall because he could be sure of hearing it twice, you know, because the echo would come back from the other wall. And that, I remember one occasion when I had to leave a prom, in fact, because the echo was so awful in the performance of very loud percussive contemporary music from the New York group Bang on a Can. I couldn't stand it, you know. It just made nonsense of the music. I had to just go.
Yeah. But they fit those flying saucers in the 60s, I think those appeared.
Yeah. Yeah, I did actually go to the hall before they appeared. I mean, that really dates me.
Mm.
And they certainly improved it. But, I mean, no doubt it is patchy, and no doubt the sound's better on the radio.
Yeah, I think it is. The other thing is, my theory is, I mean, what is the Albert Hall? It was built for lion taming, really. That's what it was built for.
All in wrestling.
All in wrestling, tennis matches, quite good there. But, I mean, I think it's, you know, the concave, that's that shape, isn't it? It basically focuses the sound to the opposite side of the hall.
Yes.
So if you're sitting on the opposite side of the hall and the peak reflective area, insert scientific term for that, you get not a bad experience. I've sat in boxes on the opposite of that, and it's really quite nice. I've also sat behind the orchestra in the gods just below the gallery, where you almost have to turn to the person next to you and ask if it's over. Because it's... You know, it's just rubbish. It's so completely rubbish. I just think, what's the point of this? But it is, nevertheless, a grand venue. It's become the home of the Proms, and there's no point in arguing any different, because they're never going to find, unless they build another one, which they won't. So there we go. That's where it is. Let's forget that question.
That's where it is, and it has so many compensating virtues, I think. You know, I like the fact that you can, you know, it's kind of red plush, you know.
Yeah,
it kind of feels grand and cozy at once.
70s cinema.
70s cinema, yes, exactly. You know, I like looking at Sir Henry with the silly wreath on his head, looking down at the Proms, seeing what they're up to, you know, seeing how many silly costumes I can spot. Of course, it has its frustrations. You know, I think in my nightmares, I'm going round that endless circular corridor looking for the men's loos. And there seem to be endless women's loos. Rightly so, of course. I mean, of course. Yeah. Absolutely right, there should be. Well, where's the men's, you know?
Yeah.
And you're running and running and thinking, I'll never find it.
You realise at one point you turn in the wrong direction and then you're running the long road. It's like, you know, when you overtake somebody on the M25, are you 50 feet in front of them or 260 miles behind them? It's like, whatever it is. So the that we just established that the general sweep of the thing is kind of as it, you know, that's to say, in the very, very broadest of terms, BBC orchestras, sprinkling of, you know, the stars, and then the swashbucklers come out at the end, and then there's the last night. And that's the kind of thing. What are the themes, actually, kind of, in terms of the music? Vaughan Williams is one.
Yeah, anniversary composers. Vaughan Williams, we're celebrating his 150th. So he's quite a constant thread throughout the programming, which is a wonderful thing. Doreen Carwithen.
Oh, yeah, her.
Am I right in thinking that she's also...
She's on the last night of the Proms with a great piece, which I just like what I hear, just for its name. Hang on a second. Right, I'm going to find it. I'll have to shuffle to the end of the last night of the Proms. Doreen Carwithen, overture to ODTAA, One Damn Thing After Another.
Yeah, it gives you a kind of impression of someone who's a bit cross, doesn't it?
Yes.
And in fact, I know from someone who... an elderly person who studied piano with her that she could be a bit cross.
Oh, really?
She was one of those old-fashioned pianists. She literally... sat next to you with a ruler in her hand and rapped your knuckles.
Oh, really? Okay, so there's Vaughan Williams, Carwithen, who knew?
Yeah, and there's a recurring theme nowadays in the Proms is more women performers, more women composers.
Yeah.
So this year we've got Ethel Smythe's The Wreckers, which is coming up from Glyndebourne.
Yeah.
A new Glyndebourne production. The piece of hers I really want to hear, because I've heard it once or twice and I really like it, is her double concerto.
For violin and horn. Now, when you talk about the increase in women sort of representation, can we be totally unethical and bad woke now by wondering out loud whether that can go too far? Whether in any, I don't mean this about women, but actually that people are chosen, this is of course the perennial argument against this kind of thing. You get chosen, people are chosen simply because of who they are rather than what they can do.
Well, I think that there is a very strong argument for, well, more than one argument for reviving these forgotten composers. Not just women, of course, but, you know, black Asian composers who've been overlooked, some of whom have been highlighted in this year's prom season, you know, just to mention one. George Walker, very fine black American composer, died in his late 90s. His trombone concerto is being done this year, one of a whole series of concertos for slightly unusual instruments.
Tuba concerto, Vaughan Williams.
Tuba concerto, violin and horn concerto of Ethel Smythe, we've already mentioned.
Violin concerto with horn obbligato.
Obbligato.
Playing a bit too loud, yeah.
So there's a kind of natural justice argument. You know, they were sidelined for reasons that weren't really to do with their music, but because it was thought that, you know, women didn't really have a place in classical music. Ditto black composers, ditto Asian composers. Another argument is that it takes a while, I think, to appreciate the worth of either a piece or a composer's output as a whole. Because it takes a certain practice to be able to hear the music. You know, the first time you hear the music of any unfamiliar composer, you probably won't get it, actually, just because you're not familiar with the idiom. You've got to hear it at least twice, preferably three times. Mm. You know, the first time I heard George Walker's Fourth Symphony, I thought, gosh, that's a bit indigestible. You know, that's proper hardline modernism. Second and third times, I started to warm to it. So it's got to be more than just one a token wheeling out of a piece and then packing it back in its box again, leaving it for another century or so.
Now, okay, so you meant we're talking in the area of revivals of first performances of commissions and so on. And I'm holding the Proms program now, which I'm going to thud on the table. That's the Proms program going on. Which it's kind of the last like fifth of it is the actual program, and the rest of it is articles. Now, one of them is written by one Ivan Hewitt at the front here.
Ah, yes, Auspicious Premiers.
Yeah, exactly, Auspicious Premiers. And it's, you probably wrote it about 4,000 years ago. You forgot what, maybe just rehashed or borrowed something you used for Music Matters in the, early 90s. But in it, you talk about the importance of the premiere, you know, and whether that augurs, a good premiere augurs well for the future success of the piece and whether the opposite is true. And you say, and I quote the good book, so be sure to give a new piece your undivided attention. You never know, you may be witnessing the birth of a classic. Has the Proms given birth to any classics?
I think the Proms has, yes, given birth to classics, which, what do I mean by classic? Well, an exemplary specimen of quality that maybe has had an influence, and it has some degree of afterlife. It gets played with reasonable frequency. Yes, Boulez's Prom Commission from 74, Pierre Boulez's commission from 1974, Rituel in Memoriam Bruna Maderna, is one of his better known pieces, I think, because it's rather unusual. It's stylistically a bit of an outlier in his piece, and it has that kind of very hieratic, rather awe-inspiring ritual quality which people can resonate with, you know, without, even if they don't like modern music very much. Yeah, there are. I mean, it's not a rich hall, shall we say?
No,
it's not considered. But there are pieces born at the Proms, commissioned with Proms money, which sit around and people rate very highly.
Yeah, very good. Okay, listen. So we are down to our top tips for the 2022 Proms season.
You mentioned the Berlin Philharmonic. I would go to the first of their two concerts. Well, of course I go to both, but if I had to choose one, I guess it would be Mahler's Seventh Symphony, because I have a very funny relationship with that piece. I find it baffling and often annoying. I mean, I find the finale completely grotesque, and the kind of opening theme just so fantastically banal. I think, how can anybody think they could base a symphonic movement on that?
For them,
yet it's fascinating.
For them struggling with their Mahler symphonies, it is, I think, probably the least accessible of the Mahler symphonies.
Yes, and several conductors have said to me that they find it the hardest to make sense of.
Yeah.
Esa-Pekka Salonen said he doesn't really grasp it.
I know somebody who did his PhD thesis on the Mahler 7th Symphony. Slow movement, just that. So, how about that?
Good God.
All right, so Let's hear your five choices.
Well, that's one.
That's one, okay.
Another of the five choices would be the Hebrides Ensemble.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's got three pieces of Xenakis, and, you know, Xenakis is becoming a bit rare since he died, you know. Mm. And it's just great to hear that music. You know, it demands the kind of seat-of-the-pants risk-taking from players, which is very thrilling. You know, even if the notes themselves are a bit baffling, the kind of tornado of energy is just fabulous.
Well, that's on in Belfast. That's the 18th of July. And I did pick that one out as well, but I thought it's Belfast. I'm never going to go there. So
yes.
if you're in Belfast, you're listening to this, you know, do that. It's fab. 8th of July. It's a lunchtime thing, 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock in the Waterfront Hall studio. Who else?
Well, I mean, another one I'm keen to hear is the BBC Philharmonic on the 18th of July. I'm very soon into the season because Ormai May Welber's conducting. He's a remarkable talent. He's leaving them quite soon. He's doing Bruckner's 6th Symphony, which, you know, is the puzzling one amongst the output, I think. I never quite get the 6th, but I think it's a very deep and interesting piece. I'm very keen to hear that. Also keen to hear the new work in that programme, which is the Viola Concerto of Cassandra Miller. I enjoyed her cello concerto, so I'm hoping the Viola Concerto will be as good.
Okay.
Yeah, well, other things. Well, there is the concert of North Indian classical music.
Right.
On the 21st of August, on the sarod, which is a kind of, well, it's a sort of plucked string instrument, which I love, and it's, you know, a bit of a rarity. You don't often hear it. And Amjad Ali Khan is a wonderful player on it. Indian music at the Royal Albert Hall, you know, you wouldn't think they would go together, would you, really?
It's been a thing since the 70s, though.
It's been a thing since, I think, 71 was when it made its first appearance.
Yeah.
So, 21st of August, that's a bit of a must for me. I think that leaves one more. One prom I'm keen to go to is Chinnicker's prom on the 2nd of September. Chinnicker being Britain and Europe's first majority black orchestra.
Mm.
It's a bit unusual because although it makes a nod to diversity in the programming in the sense that before the interval, they're going to play a tiny piece, well, a fairly small piece by George Walker, wonderful African-American composer, who we know mostly for his later modernist works, but early in his career, he wrote this delightful little curtain raiser called Lilacs, which really ought to be a popular favourite, and somehow isn't, you know, and maybe it's easy to figure out why it's not a popular favourite. You know, going back to your earlier question, should we be giving so much attention to composers that history has ignored? Well, here's an example where it's, it's absolutely plain that prejudice has to be the defining factor in a piece's neglect. Because it's so easy to listen to and so beautiful that it should be just there, you know, in the repertoire, and it's not. So that's the first piece in the programme. After the interval comes Beethoven's 9th Symphony. It's an absolute proms fixture, isn't it? And I think I'm right in saying an entirely black cast of soloists.
Yeah, fantastic.
And a black conductor. So, you know, that's interesting. What would it sound? Is it going to sound very different somehow?
Yeah.
Maybe it will. I don't know. I think it's a bold thing for, you know, because, you know, the obvious thing to do would be to get the Bernard Phil to do it, wouldn't it? But they're not, you know. So that's really interesting. So I will certainly be at that prom.
Great. Well, two final ones that I want to draw attention to, based purely on the photo. That is Dream of Gerontius, which is the 31st of August. I actually would prefer the Dream of Gerontius if it could be sung in a language I didn't understand, because it's like, okay, I like this music, but the sentiments being expressed are just so... It's like Elgar's Sea Pictures, which is like, I wish I couldn't understand this. And the other one, and one of the best pictures, if not the best, Monday the 5th of August, it's in Cardiff, and that's the Carrion Wind Quintet, who look a bit crazy. And if I could get up to Cardiff, down across to Cardiff, I would go and see that, just to see if they look like their picture. They're doing Ligeti, and that's quite an interesting programme too. So, you know, and that's a lunchtime thing. So those are our top tips. Well, listen, that has been fascinating. And anybody who has never been to the Proms, in a sentence, why go?
Because, as well as hearing probably some very fine music, very well played, you'll get a distinct flavour of something terribly English, you know. Probably more English than British, actually. Self-conscious of its own tradition, but not in an overly serious way, you know, able to mock itself. And also a very nice feeling, which you don't always get in other concert halls where classical music is played a lot, of camaraderie, you know. It's like everyone's joined together, you know. You don't, although if you're in the stalls or upper circles, you are literally looking down at the Proms. You don't look down on them in any other way, you know. In a sense, they're the ones sort of in charge somehow. They encapsulate the spirit of the thing. Those, you know, slightly eccentric people or eager people, actually. Eccentric is a slightly unkind word. Better to say eager people in the middle. They radiate this spirit of love of the music, which is very endearing, actually, and I think it helps to give the Proms its very special feeling.
Thanks very much.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I reckon we've earned our lunch, don't you?
Ivan Hewitt, what a nice man, happens to live round the corner from me, so what about that? His tips again were 18th of July, Hebrides Ensemble in Belfast, that's a lunchtime concert. Then if you're very quick or got access to a helicopter, you might be able to get back to London for the evening performance of Bruckner's Sixth Symphony. Ivan mentioned the Cassandra Miller Viola Concerto, that's actually not being played owing to ill health of one of the participants. Now Lawrence Power, the original soloist, will be playing his James McMillan Viola Concerto, a piece that was written for him. He is the dedicatee and something really worth catching. Then he said Sunday the 21st of August, Amjad Ali Khan playing Sir Rod. That's a concert that starts at 11:30. His next one was 2nd of September, Chinnike performing Beethoven's Ninth Symphony and George Walker. His final tip was on the 3rd of September, the Berlin Philharmonic doing Mahler's Seventh Symphony. I'm going to skip that and go to the Berlin Philharmonic on the 4th of September, which is Schnitger Viola Concerto and Shostakovich Symphony No. 10, because I can't stand Mahler's Seventh Symphony. Now, we've just had the second Proms, which featured Vaughan Williams' Fantasia on a theme of Thomas Tallis. Well, Vaughan Williams, 19th, 20th century composer, Thomas Tallis, 16th century. We thought we'd get update that a bit here at Proms in the Pub. So our very special guest, Harry at thepiano.com, has cooked up a Tchaikovsky Fantasia, but on a theme of Bob Marley. We hope you enjoyed listening. Don't forget to subscribe. Harry, the stage is yours.